Monty, who's a great coach and you know, has done some really great things out there. He was asleep at the wheel for most of that first half. No adjustments in terms of what you were going to do defensively to a team that was not doing much offensively. DeAndre Ayton was awful. Like, it just was a complete and utter failure from the Suns. They just had a meltdown.
Well, that's earlier this week. That's the voice of former Phoenix Sun Roger Bell, kind of succinctly summing it all up. It was a complete meltdown in Game 7. But should we have seen it coming? That is one of the questions I think people have been asking themselves since the conclusion of that game. How could it go so awry, but were there warning signs? Reggie Miller, who did a lot of that series and did a lot of postseason games for TNT for the Suns as a broadcaster and infuriated a lot of Suns fans in the process, too, with his seemingly pro-opponent remarks all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But he did a conference call, a Zoom call, with members of the media, along with Stan Van Gundy, about the NBA playoffs. And Miller said, yeah, I could see cracks before this. He said, if you date back to mid-March, once the Suns clinched home court throughout the playoffs, it was almost like they took their foot off the gas. And I go back and I tried to look for it and I couldn't find the exact soundbite. But earlier in the playoffs, and I think it was in the Dallas series, DeAndre Ayton was the one who said, we can't keep our take our foot off the pedal. We have to smash that pedal, something right. to that effect.
Right.
In the Dallas series alone, Bick, the Suns, I think, got a little full of themselves, and they took their foot off the gas pedal twice. They did it after Game 2 when they were freely talking about, you know, torturing Luka Doncic on defense, and there was all the talk about pigeons.
Oh, yeah.
And then they did it in Game 5 after a 30-point win where, you know, they were talking all kinds of smack and trying for late dunks and stuff.
But yeah.
I think
the Luka special.
I think one thing that we have not really dived into in terms of factors, yes, Dallas played better. The Suns were incredibly overconfident in this series, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. That's a really, they were kind of taken down by their own hubris on some level. I do agree that there's an element of that, and I do think that the maturity of this group as a basketball team, their emotional maturity as basketball players, they got to get that to the hardcore level. Everything else about what they do is fairly hardcore in terms of how they compete and how they approach. They need to work on that. And I think a lot of it's natural. There's a lot of young kids on that team, but you got to understand the time and the place thing. The idea of dancing your way through pregame warmups, again, I loved it. I think I'm a huge fan of Mikal Bridges, and I used to be captivated by just his routines and just how goofy they were. And so I'm not going to sit here and blame them for something that brought me a lot of entertainment and enjoyment.
I'm right there with you, and I know a lot of people say, oh, look, they're having way too much fun. Look at that tunnel celebration they're doing. That's something they did every night.
Yeah,
and just because the game gets more serious or the results become more serious and the ramifications are that, you can't change who you are. What would you say if Mikal Bridges was stone-faced in the layup line there was nobody cutting it up? That's not who the Phoenix Suns were. I have no problem with that.
That's right. But you have to also now understand on the flip side of that, there's going to be a lot of people taking offense to that. And so the time and the place thing, it certainly applies to don't crow over an opponent that has yet to be beaten, especially in a series. I think they learned some tough lessons like that. I really hope Devin Booker, you know, doesn't kind of realizes the errors of his ways individually, because he's a superstar. And he's going to take, if the Suns are going to get an NBA championship, it's going to be because of that guy. And for him to get to that level, he's got to rein in some of his emotions, in my opinion. He can't get sidetracked. It's the Rick Bucher criticism that I think is something that's spot on with Devin Booker. So I think that overconfidence, it plays into that swagger that we all love so much. I was alerted to this. I read Gerald's story from PHNX one day about that, the tunnel display by the Phoenix Suns. And what I was not aware of, and I guess I should have been, was just how it was looked at in visiting arenas. There were a lot of people on other teams in other organizations who were like, who are they? Who are they to do? What have they won? Why are they acting like that in our building? And I'm not saying I'm condemning it. I'm just saying you created that. So you got to be able to back it up.
Well, it didn't really hurt him. I think you hit on something very important earlier about the level of confidence, the level of trash talk and vanquishing of opponents. The regular season is one thing. I go back to the Minnesota game. I go back to Carl Anthony Towns pointing at his head like I just got in Jay Crowder's head. No, you just ensured you lost the game.
Right.
Now, had that been a best of seven series, who knows what transpires? And mm-hmm. I think the Suns carry that regular season attitude of like, yeah, we can respond to anything. And hey, yeah. Game five, we responded again and we beat these chumps by 30 points. This thing's over. And they played like they thought it was over. It does not apply evenly to a best of seven playoff series because of adjustments and because of the level of competition on the other side. Luka Doncic, I'm not a fan. Guess what? He's a killer.
Mm-hmm.
And he will remain a killer for years in this league. And I think the Suns found that out the really hard way.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point. So there's a lot of people who answer that when they say, what happened to the Phoenix Suns? Luka happened. Well, that's part of it. That is, without it, undeniably, that is part of the equation here when we're talking about this. And there's also the DeAndre Ayton thing too, Vinny. And it's one of those things that when we get back into this, trying to get to the bottom of whether or not he checked out on this basketball team, it's interesting to me because I've heard from fans who have pointed out, if you watch the last 10 games of the regular season, that's when his effort began to wane.
Mm-hmm.
And
we were saying how good he was in that first round.
And that's my point. I go back, I go, but yeah, I remember those Pelicans games early that he just dominated.
Yeah, but even those games, and he had three or four such games in the playoffs, even in the Dallas series, it was him picking his spot on when he wanted to dominate. And that's something that had been a continuation from the regular season. But over the last five games of that series, he lost the ability to pick his spots. To get to his spot, to pick his spots, to identify the opportunity. Hey, this team needs a bucket right now.
Uh-huh.
It just wasn't there. Yeah. And if that's all from wearing down because of what New Orleans did in the first round, as Reggie Miller had also suggested, that's the worst case scenario.
Yeah, the worst case scenario is us continuing to give Reggie Miller credit for being a good analyst.
Well, look, we have to give Reggie Miller credit. We have to give Rick Bucher credit. And begrudgingly, we have to give Nick Wright credit.
Oh, God. What have we become?
I know. We're a beaten...
You did this to us, Suns!
We're a beaten market. Coming up next, in DeAndre Hopkins' absence, all eyes will be on Hollywood Brown. And there's a lot of eyes on Hollywood Brown from around the league right now, too. We'll tell you what they said next. Bickley and Marotta Mornings, 98.7 FM, Arizona Sports Station.
Bickley and Marotta.
Dan Bickley and Vince Marotta.
Bickley and Marotta Mornings. 98.7 FM. Arizona's sports station.
It's been a lot of big plays. I mean, I play with a lot of passion, a lot of excitement. And, you know, however I got to do, you know, to help the team win, I'm definitely going to do it.
That is Marquise Hollywood Brown. Last week, actually a couple weeks ago on Big Red Rage. When asked the question by Paul Calvisi and Ron Wolfley about what can fans expect from you now that he's a member of the Arizona Cardinals, that was the biggest headline from the Cardinals draft weekend, obviously. They trade their number 23 pick to Baltimore. There'd been a lot of receivers drafted before. The way Steve Keim explained it, the way the board transpired before them, it made sense to make that deal. So they send the number 23 pick and they get Hollywood Brown. Now, they did give up a first-round pick for a receiver, which is something they didn't have to do in the offseason when they got DeAndre Hopkins.
Mm-hmm.
Then we find out Hopkins is suspended for the first six games. So the role and I think the expectations, the pressure already builds on Hollywood Brown to produce. We were both in the camp, Bic, of, hey, normally speaking, you don't like when a team trades a first-round pick.
Yeah.
It made sense to me. I think they addressed a big need, ideally. It doesn't make sense to everybody. There's a piece on The Athletic written by Jeff Howe about Hollywood Brown's possible payday, and it starts out like this. The Hollywood Brown trade during the first round of the NFL draft raised antenna for a couple of reasons. First, people around the NFL were surprised the Cardinals made the move, acquiring Brown and a third-round pick for the number 23 selection. Quote, Baltimore won that one by a lot, end quote, one team executive said. Another source whose team plays for the Cardinals in 2022 added, bad trade for them, good trade for us. Which, based on, you know, the viewpoint, we don't know what opponent it was. We don't know who said it. Don't you think Hollywood Brown in a matchup in 2022 is probably going to impact things more than a first-round pick would have? Especially considering the Cardinals' recent first-round draft history?
Without a doubt. But that doesn't mean it, that doesn't make it a good move. But
no.
I think this criticism gets a little sideways sometimes because people saw what the Eagles did with A.J. Brown. And so when they go and they get A.J. Brown for a first-round pick as well, they're getting way more wide receiver than the Cardinals do. And so people see that and think that the Cardinals overpaid badly for Hollywood Brown. What they don't know is that A.J. Brown was going to cost a ton of money in salary. The Eagles had to pay him, what, $25 million
per year? Yeah, that was a $100 million deal for him.
So the Cardinals weren't going to do that, so A.J. Brown was not a viable option for the Arizona Cardinals, and so they got a guy who's a dangerous player, but he's also a very close friend of Kyler Murray, and he's also relatively affordable for 2 years. So to me, I think that there are reasons why it cost the Cardinals what it cost them, and what they did was far better in the short term than using it on any player who would have been there.
And it was the perfect acquisition on two fronts. One, they absolutely needed a number two to complement DeAndre Hopkins.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And as it turned out, they absolutely needed someone to replace DeAndre Hopkins for the first six games.
Mm-hmm.
And they wound up getting someone, you know, that could fill both roles.
Well, that's the other thing, too. And I don't think it was the end-all, be-all, because I think that deal was in the works for a while. Cliff Kingsbury was very hesitant to answer a question last week about whether or not the Cardinals knew on draft day that DeAndre Hopkins would be suspended, and he kind of put it on Steve Keim's plate. They knew. They absolutely knew.
But this
wasn't a six-game acquisition. This was our offense was broken last year by the end of the year, and we better get some more weapons in here to help take pressure off of Kyler Murray, to help take pressure off DeAndre Hopkins. And they accomplished that on draft weekend on a couple of fronts with Brown and with Trey McBride.
And as I said, given the fact that Steve Keim's draft history has been so sketch at best, that to argue that you could have better used that first-round pick is kind of laughable. The only guy that I saw that they missed out on by trading out of 23 was Jermaine Johnson, who was a defensive end out of Florida State, who might have fitted what they were looking for in an edge rusher. But again, these are unproven commodities, and given the batting average of the general manager in the draft, I think what they did deserves an A grade. So I understand people are entitled to what they want to believe about that guy, but the serving Kyler Murray aspect of it, I don't know how you put a price tag on that.
Part of, you know, a lot of this is tongue-in-cheek, but you're right. Jermaine Johnson might have fit what they need as an edge rusher. And now that he has not been drafted by the Cardinals, I think he will be an excellent player in the NFL. Had he been drafted by the Cardinals.
He went to the Jets.
Not exactly. Their history of cashing in on draft picks is not that great either. And again, that's tongue-in-cheek. There was also a story, I found this interesting, a piece on NFL.com that Chad Reeder put together about third-day draft picks this past draft.
All right.
And their top candidates to actually wrestle a lot of starting playing time. Number three on the list was Keyonte Ingram, the draft pick out of USC, the running back. Third on the list, he wrote, Ingram's rushing and receiving ability out of the backfield give him a chance at the lion's share of work when James Conner is not on the field. Conner has missed at least three games in four of his five seasons in the league, and he only started 6 of 15 appearances last year while splitting time with the now-departed Chase Edmonds in the backfield. Chances are good Ingram will start several games as a rookie. Now, he's competing with a couple of other guys that have a couple of years of institutional knowledge on the Cardinals. Eno Benjamin was also a seventh-round pick.
Right.
Who, when he got opportunities last year, actually did something with them. Jonathan Ward has been serviceable.
It's my guy.
I think it's going to be interesting to see how that room materializes. I wouldn't say it's a foregone conclusion. Ingram's good, But I wouldn't say it's a foregone conclusion that he's the guy behind James Conner right away.
No, either would I. I think he was only okay at USC. I know the kid was very, very highly rated coming out of high school, and I know he can catch the ball.
Well, he got there at a weird time, too.
Right after a coach got fired.
Their best receiver got hurt in Drake London, and that offense, that was a messy team last year. Let's be honest.
But that's a good point.
He didn't put up huge numbers at Texas either when he was there.
No, so I think you just summarized that perfectly. I'm not sure really what to think of him. I think the Cardinals draft has a chance to be good. I like a couple of the things they did. This Trey McBride kid, I'm real curious to see how he translates, right?
But a lot of people think the Lasita Smith pick from Virginia Tech was one of the steals of the draft. Marquise Hayes in the seventh round was supposedly a steal that shouldn't have been there, so... I agree with you. I'm not going to get over the moon on any draft because I've had a lot of egg on my face in the past when I've done that. It's time for Character Counts, brought to you by Parker & Sons Heating, Cooling, and Plumbing. On Tuesday, the Arizona Cardinals donated 200,000 meals to the United Food Bank in a partnership with Albertsons and Safeway. Cardinals linebacker Dennis Gardeck. Wide receiver Antoine Wesley and offensive lineman Kelvin Beachum, DJ Humphreys and Justin Murray, and Eric Smith presented a $40,000 check to the food bank and helped pack meals. The United Food Bank collects, acquires, stores, and distributes food to over 150 partner agencies across five counties. Last year, the food bank distributed more than 22.7 million pounds of food and 52,000 meals per day. Arizona Cardinals Senior VP of Business Development Steve Ryan said, quote, "The Cardinals are thrilled to align with Albertsons Safeway and the United Food Bank to highlight food insecurity while supporting and feeding those in need within our Arizona communities." Well done to the Arizona Cardinals. That is Character Counts. It's brought to you by Parker & Sons Heating, Cooling, and Plumbing. Coming up next, the big stories of the day repackaged through the reboot. Sarah Cazell will take us through it next. It's Bickley & Murata Mornings live from the Ak-Chin Community Studios here at 98.7 FM, Arizona Sports Station.
98.7 FM, Arizona's sports station. Bickley & Murata Mornings. Rush Hour Reboot. Rush Hour Reboot. Getting you up to speed on everything happening in sports this morning. Brought to you by Brooklyn Betting. That's American-owned and American-dreamed Brooklyn Betting.
Good morning, everybody. Happy Friday, if that means anything to you. I am Sarah Cazell with Bickley & Murata Mornings. It's the Rush Hour Reboot when we take you through the top stories of the day every single day. I am joined by Dan Bickley.
Hey!
Vince Murata.
Hello.
I don't know how long this goes for.
We got 10 minutes.
Sorry.
Wow, that was something I'd never heard before.
That was my Erykah Badu impersonation.
Ooh, oh, okay. Shame Badu on me for not knowing that. And Jarrett Carlin.
It's the happiest time of the day, kids.
Yes,
now he's playing
this.
Sound bites of me.
Like, yes.
This is getting out of control.
No, I love it. All right, let's start with the Phoenix Suns, guys. Yesterday, around this very time, actually, we were joking on the show about tracking DeAndre Ayton's agent, whoever he is.
Yes.
To keep an eye out for the
Bill Duffy?
Exactly. The Eric Burkhart-like, 3 pages long, 8-font, strongly worded letter.
Right.
On behalf of DA, who is looking for big money this summer. So not too long after making that joke, we did hear from Bill Duffy, DeAndre Ayton's agent. He went on NBA Today on Sirius XM, which includes Suns analyst Eddie Johnson. Here is what Bill Duffy had to say about the situation his client is in.
So, look, I mean, we're disappointed. We wanted a max contract, and he went out. He was a soldier the whole year, played well, improved his statistics. So, you know, we're proud of him. You know, a lot of guys handle things differently, but he was very mature about it, and the team did well. As far as that last game, you know, it was just an anomaly. I mean, Luka just attacked, and things didn't work out. But, you know, things will work out for DeAndre. He's a valuable player, and there's other teams in the league as well. He's a restricted free agent, so we'll see how this process unfolds.
There's other teams in the league as well. He
29
says.
Of them, to be exact.
Oh, good point.
Yeah.
So, given the reports that we've been discussing this week from Flex from Jersey, is it fair to call them reports? the assertions made from Flex from New Jersey?
That's a good question.
Okay.
It depends how you sacred you use the word reports.
It's information.
The information, yes.
It's information.
The information from this guy who clearly has a source with the Sun somewhere, saying that DeAndre Ayton for months now has been expressing internally his desire to go elsewhere. You know, everyone knows the situation right now. In retrospect, would the Suns have been better off giving DeAndre Ayton a deal before last season, or do you think the Suns were right to hold off on giving him a new deal?
Ooh. No, I think they should have. I've said it in real time, so I'm not going to go back on it now. I'm not going to hold what we just saw in this postseason or a report about video games that may or may not be embellished against the fact that you've invested in this kid. This kid has grown. To abandon him now would be quite something. So, I think if there was any weirdness related to that contract, that obviously could have been avoided. So, yeah, I think that they messed this up.
Yeah, there's I think Bick said it well. We were both in agreement, and I think both somewhat surprised that didn't happen last summer after what we saw from DeAndre Ayton, specifically in the NBA playoffs. So, yeah, they probably should have done it by now.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows? Maybe things end differently.
Sometimes
there's people that believe that the contract status of DeAndre Ayton hung over the Suns' head. Eddie House, former Phoenix Sun, we've had him on the show a million times. He went on the Colin Cowherd show and he said, "Yeah, I think that was a factor in why they played the way they played."
Really?
We don't know.
So did I.
Yeah. I can play that for you.
Sure. Please do. Thanks for doing my job.
Thing about DeAndre Ayton not signing him. I think that affected that team a whole lot. I think that wore down on the team. And that was something that was looming over all season long. And they kind of played through it. But I just think it came to a head in Game 7. And when the pressure started ratcheting up from Dallas, and then they're at home and nobody's knocking down shots.
Mm. And then if you want to go deeper on speculation, too, I mean, Monty Williams uncharacteristically snaps and pulls DeAndre Ayton out of the game and asked him if he wanted to play. There may have been a use of the Q word. Did you quit on us? That maybe manifests itself in that particular situation more if a player had been internally talking about, hey, I want to move on.
Yeah. Well, that's would explain that. And there is, and again, I told that story of wanting to pursue that storyline with Monty Williams, and he wanted no part of it.
Yeah.
Right.
So you add up the circumstantial stuff, you can make a case that something happened.
Yeah.
But why would it surface now?
Right.
If he was so good all year long, why would it surface now?
Because that's how ugly Game 7 was. Dredges up a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess. I guess there's something to it. All right, let's go on to college football. Man, speaking about ugly, woof. Things got ugly, specifically in the SEC between Nick Saban and Jimbo Fisher. Earlier this week, in case you somehow missed it, Nick Saban said at an event that Texas A&M bought every single player in their last recruiting class. Jimbo Fisher did not care for that. He fired back yesterday. He called Nick Saban a narcissist, said the accusations are despicable. Go dig into Nick Saban's past, find out who he really is. And then the crown jewel to me, at least, this quote from Jimbo Fisher: some people think they're God. Go dig into how God did his deal. You may find out about a guy a lot of things you don't want to know.
Wow.
That led to a lot of really good, like, Old Testament, New Testament jokes on Twitter. It was great stuff. Here's Paul Feinbaum, who has covered SEC football forever and ever, on this situation.
He's really in a two-prong war with Kirby Smart to the east, who had 15 draft choices. He's got Jimbo out there. Now he has Brian Kelly in Baton Rouge. And I know people cringe when we talk about age. I'm not that young myself. But Saban will turn 71. That will be used against him. You know, while he's winning championships, it won't. But, you know, he looks a little more vulnerable today, guys. And I Jimbo decided, I've got bombs in my arsenal. I'm letting go. And, you know, Saban can backpedal. He can crawfish. But Jimbo Fisher drew blood yesterday. And that's the first time I've seen somebody do that on Nick Saban.
He can crawfish. That's the first time I've heard that one.
I've never heard that either.
He gave a lot of good. I mean, he used the term two-prong war. That's a great name for a band right there.
It is a
great band name. So my question is, with the way the transfer portal is now, with the way NIL is now, does this week mark the end of Nick Saban's white-knuckle grip on the college football landscape? Is he losing some control here?
I think he's losing some control,
yeah.
But I don't think it's based on what Jimbo Fisher said. I mean, the most recent champion was not Alabama. They mm-hmm. ran into some injury problems. They got handled by Georgia in the national championship game. The landscape is changing within the SEC. It's rough. So I think his grip is not as tight as it once was, but I don't think it's all related to what we've seen this week.
He feels very threatened now because he built an empire based on how much money he was going to make the best football players in America in the future. He's losing his grip because those players are getting it now in college.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of having to go to Alabama to get your money later is kind of being marginalized by the idea of go where the money is right now.
And then get it
Very
later.
Well, and so. Then get it later.
Yes, and also get it later. If we have time, do we have time, Jarrett? Are you going to yell at me if
Shut
I ask
up,
one
Jarrett.
More question? Okay, with how crazy the transfer portal and NIL deals and whatnot have become, we talked about this, I think, in the 6:45 segment. When do you guys think we will see any sort of regulations come down, any kind of peeling back, or will we? Will it just stay at this level?
No, I don't know. As Vinny said, maybe creating a time window would be a way to kind of marginalize this, but I read something from somebody yesterday that all of college football, all of college athletics are acting like the NCAA is powerless.
Yeah.
That there is no enforcement arm to the NCAA anymore.
And they're Bill Selfing it.
Yeah. Or
Sean Millering
it. Or Herm Edwardsing it.
Yeah. Well, how nice that two of those three are from Arizona.
Hey, it's what Arizona does.
we lose, heat, but we're going to cheat.
Dry heat and NCAA investigations. That's what Arizona does.
Right.
Tremendous.
It is tremendous.
And we're all rebooted.
Yes, you are.
Thank you, Sarah. Rush Hour Reboot every morning at 7:30. Coming up next, outside of the Suns' exit from the NBA playoffs, this tournament has sucked. We'll get into more details of it next. Bickley and Murata Mornings, 98.7 FM, Arizona Sports Station.
The broadcasters of your area in voluntary cooperation with federal, state, and local authorities
Dan Bickley, Vince Murata.
Bickley and Murata Mornings.
98.7 FM, Arizona's sports station.
Oh, the NBA playoffs roll on. Another blowout last night in Miami as the Celtics had their way with the Heat. This has been the playoffs defined by blowouts. It is amazing how many 20-point blowouts we've seen so far. There's been, I think, a real lack of signature games or great series. Even the two games that have gone the full seven, and those were in the second round, one in the East, one in the West. Game sevens were both blowouts in the Phoenix-Dallas series and the Milwaukee-Boston series.
Mm-hmm.
I counted up all the blowouts in the first round, and this is where it really makes less sense. In the first round, where you have, you know, seemingly the also-rans still playing, there were seven total games that were 20-point blowouts or more, Bick. In the second round, when the field gets stronger, supposedly, there were 10 blowouts, including a lot of 30-point blowouts. And already, out of the three games we've seen played in the conference finals, two of them have been 20-point blowouts. This has been a dreadful NBA postseason, and I'm not just saying that because the Suns are not in it anymore.
Yeah,
it's been bad.
Yeah, listen, I think the matchups haven't been the greatest. I think the best matchup in the East has already happened, and that was the Bucks-Celtics. I think that in basketball, the way these playoff games go now, so much is predicated, except for Game 7 for the Suns, on home court advantage, and that does something to your role players. It makes you shoot the ball better. And when you shoot the ball better and you take a lot of threes, games get sideways. And if they're playoff games, what I think we've seen is some teams go, okay, not our night. Chris Paul even said that during the Mavs series. He said the best thing about playing in playoff games is that you lose one by 20, you're not down 20 zipped when you start the next game.
Yeah.
So teams, they shut it down. If they get weighed down at some stage in the fourth quarter, you might get in the team's not fighting that hard to get back.
But
what I'm trying to say.
Even going back to Game 7, where the Suns, as soon as Dallas made their push, the Suns, just anything resembling fight, just melted away. Even in last night's game, Boston got just insanely hot in the first quarter. They built themselves a nice cushion. It grew. But even in the second half, when it should have been garbage time and just shutting it down, the Heat got it down to like 16, which is not embarrassing now that the Celtics stretched it out again, but at least they showed fight. Mm-hmm. That was one of the things that was so weird about it, and we'll continue to talk about it. The Suns never made a push ever in that game.
No, it was insane how they got outscored by, you know, a lot in the first quarter in a game seven, then got outscored by even more in the second quarter. And then I think the most surprising was that they got outscored by double digits in the third quarter.
Yeah.
The Suns.
Yeah.
Because you'd think that, like, to have any sort of, like, heart and toughness to show, you know, in game seven, you at least come out of the half and try to get it down to, like, 15 or something.
Ugh. Yeah. So that Boston-Miami series, it's even at 1-1. It's been, again, talk about a blowout quarter. The third quarter of game one is the only quarter the Miami Heat have won in this series so far. But they're even. They have to feel really fortunate because they've been thoroughly outplayed.
Mm-hmm. Remember how epic we thought the Eastern playoffs were going to be? That like every matchup in every round was going to be like a battle and a grind and stuff, and it's just been very unmemorable.
Yeah, I think that I think the closest point differential for a full series was actually the only series that was a sweep.
Mm-hmm.
I would have to double check it, but Boston sweeping Brooklyn in the first round, they were four close games. There was no blowouts in that series. Every other series has been dotted by blowouts.
Yeah. True.
And we saw one in game one of the Western Conference Finals. Dallas looked flat. Dallas looked tired, quite honestly, that they had to exert so much energy in that Suns series to come back from that 3-2 deficit. And there's a lot of people asking, all right, you know, Andrew Wiggins was at the forefront of slowing down Luka Doncic in game one.
Mm-hmm.
And Luka had been one of those players that, hey, you know what you're penciling in for him. It's 30 to 40 points, 10 rebounds, 10 assists. Well, he had a really bad game, a really bad second half. Yeah. And Wiggins is getting a lot of the credit for it.
He sat the whole fourth quarter, basically.
He did, but, you know, they made life tough for him in the third quarter.
I agree.
And that was probably a smart move, resting him in the fourth. Are you of the belief that Golden State and Andrew Wiggins specifically can keep that up?
No, I am not. I think that Luka will have his moments. I think a lot of it is exactly what you said. I think teams that play and win emotional seven-game series, and for Dallas coming back from a 2-0 deficit against the Suns, certainly qualified. And there was a lot of heat in that series. And as you said, the Mavs internalized a lot of that, and they were feeling very vindicated by the end of that. I think teams like that can get their doors blown off in game one on the road.
Yeah.
And it's not always, and it's not necessarily what happened to them. I like what you guys said earlier. I think what's going to happen in that series is it's going to be the Warriors are going to win both games at home, and then the Mavs are going to shine at home. And then we'll see what happens maybe in a game six. Who knows? Or if the Warriors plow through the Mavericks, that's gonna hurt me. I know a lot of people want to see Luka lose. I want to see some validation that the Suns didn't just squander a prime opportunity.
That's interesting because noted dullard Luke Lipinski was saying on his show. He was saying on his show that just the opposite, that by seeing Golden State dominate the entire time would make him feel better and say, like, well, even if the Suns won, they would have lost to Golden State anyway.
Because that's the other way to look at it.
I neither way feels good because you just wanted to have seen the thing. It would be sort of an extra knife in the gut if the Mavericks can't make any adjustments for Golden State.
I can't shake the feeling that watching Memphis, because I love Ja Morant and I have since college, watching them play the Warriors, I wanted the Warriors to win even though I don't like the Warriors at all, and it's because I wanted that matchup. I assumed the Suns were getting there.
Yep. Well, the whole season.
So did they.
The whole season. It's true. That's the biggest problem. The whole season we thought Suns-Warriors, Suns-Warriors. That's what people are already talking about after game one, is that if this is a blowout series, like, how did we get robbed of Suns-Warriors for this?
We were all guilty of it. We looked at the bracket when it came out. Who do you want to play in? Do you want a rematch against Milwaukee in the finals? We got so... Everybody in this town, well, not everybody, but a good number of people got way over their ski tips.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's the other thing, is that, no one will talk about it because everyone is so in love with the Warriors, if John Morant doesn't get hurt, the Grizzlies very likely could win that series. I mean, they lost two super close games.
The Grizzlies should have won that series.
Yeah.
And that's why it was so weird to me. I'm like, I want Golden State to get through this, even though I want Memphis to win, because I want that matchup with the Suns. And to think the Suns were the team that didn't get there is quite something.
I don't think Dallas will shoot the ball as poorly as they did in game one.
Yeah.
And Golden State, their overall shooting percentage was devastating. They shot 56% from the floor, but they only made 10 threes. Mm-hmm. I think the three-point barrage is coming tonight from Golden State. I think game two is going to be ugly as well.
Golden State, you talk about the 50-40-90 club for players. They did that as a team in game one.
No, they missed a bunch of free throws.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
I thought they did.
56% from the floor, 34% from three-point range, and 63%
from the line. Where did I hear that wrong?
I heard it, too, but I think it was applied to another team.
Okay. Maybe it was Boston?
I think it was Miami in game one.
Okay. All right. Gotcha.
But, yeah, okay. That's pretty rare to be able to do that.
I do agree with you. I do think that it's probably going to – that Dallas is not going to be able to match Golden State shot-making. Not in San Francisco.
Yeah, it wasn't Miami either. I got to look that up now.
Might have been Boston last night.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, because that barrage they went on in the first mm-hmm. quarter was unreal. Mm-hmm. Just everybody hitting shots from deep. It's so demoralizing. You live by the three, you die by the three.
Who do you think wins that series? Because everyone's now saying, oh, a full-strength Boston is so much better than Miami.
Well, Kyle Lowry's going to come back at some point, but I liked Boston going in, and I still like Boston.
It was Boston last night.
Was it?
Yeah. 51 from the field, 50% from three, 91% from the stripe.
Wow. It's impressive stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Coming up next, we are halfway through on this Friday. Bick will kick off the second half of the show like he does. The Bickley Blast is next. It's Bickley and Marotta Mornings, 98.7 FM, Arizona Sports Station.